Greetings, listeners. This is VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old-Timers Club of Australia, with this month's news and information bulletin for members and friends of the club for December 2025. I am Andrew, a VK3 Charlie Alpha Hotel. Details on when to hear the news and information bulletins are available at the club's website, www.raotc.org.au. VK3OTN is available on a wide range of radio platforms, HF, VHF and UHF, along with 2-metre repeaters, amateur television, DMR, that is digital mobile radio, and D-Star. These news broadcasts are available for download for up to 6 months, just in case you missed the original news broadcast from the RAOTC website. Just put RAOTC into your favourite search engine. If you'd like to contact the club, then why not send us an email? Our address is raotc@raotc.org.au. I hope you enjoy this month's news broadcast. Welcome to the latest club news for December 2025. It's coming into the festive season, and this gives time for many of us to get together with friends and family and catching up with old acquaintances, as well as perhaps making some New Year's resolutions. This allows many of us to ponder some situations that many usually try to avoid. Hopefully, the following thoughts will allow you to see how I came to this topic. Some years ago, one of my uncles, who was a retired electrical engineer in another big city in another state, decided that as a new retirement activity, he'd restore some older valve broadcast radios. I'd given up on trying to get his mind around the idea of becoming a radio amateur in order to broaden his social activities and at the same time offering a technical interest. So, he set about collecting old radios in various states of disrepair. He trawled around eBay and various other outlets and in a few years had a collection of around 30 or more radios, of which I think he partially restored two of them. He never bothered joining the HRSA, which is the Historical Radio Society of Australia, preferring to go it alone. Fast forward a few years and he had to move out of his family home into a low care age facility. His family, who lived nearby, were faced the disposal of his collection of radios, as well as a lot of other things, and they approached me as to what to do, and they had no idea where to start. I certainly had nowhere to keep 30 old mantle radios if I transported them to Melbourne. It looked like at the time they were indeed going straight to landfill. After a few phone calls, they were put in touch with a member of the local chapter of the HRSA who still lived quite some distance away. Their best offer available was around $300 for the whole lot, a tiny fraction of what they originally spent buying them. The takeaway from this is, if you are happy to have your life's collection of equipment, books and so forth goes into landfill, or sold for a price that makes Black Friday sales look extravagant, then the good news is, sit back, relax and do absolutely nothing. Shortly, John, VK3MK, will expand on this and give us a collection of thoughts that listeners will also find on our website. With the RAOTC being a national club, it's really outside the core goals of the club to be involved in resolving Silent Keys equipment disposal. To have a person turn up totally unknown to a bereaved family to help out with a shack clear out at best is somewhere between disrespectful and insulting. If the bereaved family is in another part of the country, then the whole idea becomes even more nonsensical. However, don't laugh. As it has been suggested by one or two individuals that RAOTC should engage in this activity. As usual, there is a bit of a joke at the end of the broadcast, but not just yet. Over the festive season, discuss this with your family and other amateur friends, and with New Year's resolutions not far away, if you are not a member of a local radio club, then why not consider joining one? With the demise of the online call register, the ACMA no longer seem to operate, there's really little stopping a family member putting your equipment on, say, Facebook Marketplace or eBay, for a tiny fraction of what it's really worth. The buyer may not even be a licensed amateur. There seems to be no easy way to check these days. They can look up the ACMA database and choose a call sign that may either be allocated or not, and then proceed to get on air as a pirate with equipment that was once yours at a very low cost. It's not unknown for entire shack clear-outs to go straight into landfill. Is this the legacy you wish to leave? Requests for help. Recently I asked if someone would step forward to help out with the VK6 or News West broadcast with some of our long-serving members not physically able to continue. The team in VK6 are still after someone to record promos for the local News West broadcast, and being News West, should ideally be somewhere located in VK6. I'll talk more about the perils of sitting back and letting someone else carry the weight until the wheels fall off in a future broadcast. Why not treat yourself this festive season? Now, if you're stuck for an idea for a Christmas present and want to buy something for yourself for a change, then here's a couple of ideas. For the tiny sum of $25, you can buy yourself a digital copy of every OTN ever published. And another idea is to consider treating yourself to the life membership of REOTC. And that way, you never have to worry about renewing your membership again. It's just that, membership for life. Further details are available on the club's website, www.raotc.org.au. New members and silent keys. Today I am pleased to welcome the following new member to the RAOTC. Glenn Baffles, a VK6 Zulu Echo, became full member number 1896 on October 12, 2025. The committee looks forward to you enjoying a long and rewarding membership of the RAOTC. Silent keys. It is with regret I report the following silent keys that have come to the attention of our membership officer. Blaine Bayliss, VK3RF, member number 1412. And Graham McDiarmid, VK3NE, member number 1485. Let us pause for a moment in memory of our departed colleagues. And that's about all the club news we have for you this month. Now I'll hand the microphone over to John, VK3MK.
You are listening to VK3OTN and associated relay stations.
Planning ahead, disposal of deceased radio amateurs' equipment. This article is an edited version of one that was prepared by Ian Godsell, VK3JS, some time ago at the request of the RAOTC committee, and is something all radio old-timers should think about. Till death us do part is usually associated with marriage. A similar sentiment probably exists amongst amateur radio operators regarding their equipment. We all know operators who never get rid of anything, and those who upgrade regularly as well as adding to their shacks when a new interest comes along. All this is fine and it helps the sale of new gear. However, time passes and we eventually get to a point where we think of retiring and possibly start to run into health difficulties, which for some may lead to a lessening of on-air activity and interest in the hobby of amateur radio. This is normal enough, but sadly the next step is often overlooked, and that is making arrangements for our final illness and eventual death. For many of us, a family member has been asked to look after our affairs, but the question arises, have we fully briefed this loved one on all our wishes? If we have not, then we run the risk of a relative suddenly being confronted with a room full of that stuff and having no idea what to do with it. Particularly if we have a large tower and beam antennas in the back garden. Are you in this category? Even if you're still in good health and quite active in the hobby? Have you wondered what to do with your rigs if you do get sick? or what will happen to your beloved equipment in the event of your death? If this is you, but you've not thought about it, then it is suggested that you stop for a moment and consider these questions. The Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club is sometimes asked if there is somewhere to go with Dad's equipment. While the club can offer advice about who can assist, it does not offer a resale service. The RAOTC committee feels that it is a subject that needs to be aired for the general good. One could always ask the WIA, Amateur Radio Victoria, or the local radio club. The departed radio amateur may have been a member of a local radio club, so that would be the place to start. Some clubs will try to sell off used equipment, or an individual member may help out, especially if he had been good friends with the deceased. But it is something that we should think about and not leave until it is too late. It's not being melodramatic or tempting fate, just being realistic. May you enjoy your hobby for many years to come, but like Boy Scouts, be prepared. This article is also available on the club's website, www.raotc.org.au. If, after hearing this, you still have questions about the disposal of the equipment of a deceased radio amateur, you can contact the RAOTC committee, either by email or telephone. Contact details can be found on the club's website or in OTN. This is John, VK3MK.
Thanks very much, John. This month, once again, we have several interesting technical articles for you. First up is an article read by Bill Roper, VK3BR, and a discussion on the AVO moving coil multimeter, which I'm sure many amateurs will have encountered over the years. This will be followed by an article read by Clive, a VK6CSW, who will tell us about the world's first telegraph network. I hope you enjoy both these articles. So now, let's hand the microphone over to Bill, a VK3BR.
The AVO Moving Coil Multimeter. This is an article written by Mike Smith, a specialist technical writer, and was published in the July-August 2013 issue of Radio Comms, and I quote, "The remarkable AVO Mark 7 moving coil multimeter remained in production from 1936 to 1986. No self-respecting engineer was without one. It doesn't seem that many years ago, when the average radio engineer or technician had a very limited arsenal at his or her disposal for identifying and correcting problems. High-class workshops might have had an oscilloscope running at 10 MHz with a single trace and costing a fortune. There was that mysterious instrument known as a Bell voltmeter that largely presented a high impedance load to the circuit under investigation, and there were signal generators and wattmeters, and more specialized instruments such as the grid dip meter, field strength meter, and the SWR meter. But apart from the ubiquitous small screwdriver in the top pocket, the tool most technicians relied on was the moving coil multimeter, and if it was worth its salt at all, it had to be one from the AVO range, the first of which appeared in 1923 as a seven-range instrument. The model most well known to radio engineers was the Mark 7, specifically designed for radio work. It was promoted as a high-sensitivity device for radio and electronics and stayed in production from 1936 to 1986. With 1,000 ohms per volt sensitivity, a current range to 10 amps, and a voltage range extending out to 1,000, the Mark 7 also had power factor and wattage units available as add-ons to increase its versatility. Each AVO, amps, volts, ohms, model had a very long production run, and some were quite extraordinary. The Model 8, for example, was introduced in 1951 and continued until 2008, the year of the company's demise. Even the earliest models had the large, distinctive, kidney-shaped viewing area, which was to last until the end. They all had knife-edge pointers and a parallax correcting mirror. These meters, although regarded with great affection by their thousands of users, were eventually overtaken by technology. The makers did not wish to follow up. The digital multimeter, or DMM, became master of the field, and instruments such as the Bell voltmeter faded into irrelevancy. Having said that, there are still many people out there who prefer the comfort and familiarity of a moving coil meter and its needle that swings across a scale. Precise measurement may be a little more of a challenge, especially in the low ohms range. But it is the skill of using an instrument with a Rolls-Royce pedigree that is part of the attraction. While today's analog multimeters have great sensitivity, sometimes up to 100,000 ohms per volt, and a wide selection of switchable ranges, many of them have relatively small display scales that make it difficult to get an accurate reading. Compare a digital multimeter whose overall accuracy may be 0.8% with an analog struggling at 3%, and it soon becomes obvious why AVO has slipped from the lexicon and the workbench. There is little doubt that the digital multimeter currently reigns supreme. A very high impedance that puts minimal load on the circuit under test, and its great accuracy have ensured its universal adoption. Oscilloscopes, too, have advanced out of sight. Once they were a desktop fixture. Today they can be carried in the pocket like a multimeter. Speeds have gone through the roof. There are color displays, huge data storage, and multiple traces. The specs have risen, prices have fallen. So we've come a long way from the AVO 7. They are now collector's items with asking prices far above the original cost. But hopefully, the much-loved and sought-after instrument will not become as extinct as the Tasmanian tiger. Now, this item was sent in by Ron, VK3AFW, who comments, and again I quote, "I don't completely agree with Smith. The AVO Model 7 was a very significant advance and widely used from the mid-1930s. It was the Model 8 which I used in the laboratory off and on for 20 years, which was, I believe, the most widely known and used of them all, and was produced in large quantities over a longer time, albeit with different marks. It was sensitive, 20,000 ohms per volt, versatile, and combined good accuracy with ruggedness. The scale was of a reasonable size, and the mirror allowed accurate, relative readings without parallax."
Thanks very much, Bill.
You are listening to VK3OTN. VK3OTN is the official station of the Radio Amateur Old Timers Club, Australia, Incorporated, with the monthly news and information bulletin for members and friends of the club.
The world's first telegraph network. Napoleonic semaphore was the world's first telegraph network, carrying messages across 19th century France faster than ever before. Now, a group of enthusiastic amateurs are reviving the ingenious system. Before the web, before the computer, before the phone, even before Morse code, there was Le Système Chap. Not for the first time or for the last, at the end of the 18th century, France made an important technological advance, only to see it overtaken by newer science. In this case, it was the world's first ever system of telegraphy. According to most accounts, the very word telegraph, distance writing in Greek, was coined to describe Claude Chappe's nationwide network of semaphore. At its most extensive, it comprised 534 stations, covering more than 5,000 kilometres or 3,106 miles. Messages sent from Paris could reach the outer fringes of the country in a matter of 3 or 4 hours. Before, it had taken dispatch riders on horseback a similar number of days. But then it ended almost as quickly as it began. In the 1840s and 50s, electronic telegraphy, with stations set up along the new railway lines, began to take over. The shack stations disappeared into obscurity, plundered for materials and buried in vegetation. Only in recent years has a resurgence of amateur interest permitted a handful of sites to be rescued from oblivion. One such is the station of Mollard Fleury, halfway up a mountainside near Medan in the French Alps. Enthusiasts worked out the probable location by consulting maps in the archives in Paris. In 2002, they found the remains of the post in woods above the village of Sardier. Now they have just built an exact replica, using original designs drawn up by an inspector on the line. Visitors who make it up the brisk climb find a two-room cabin of wood and stone. The second room contains a system of wheels and pulleys, controlling the signal system, which is set on a mast above the roof. A panoramic view looks southeast across the valley to more snow-capped mountains. Beyond is Italy. This station was part of the Lyon to Milan line that Napoleon built in 1805 as he prepared to resume war in Italy, explains Bernard Pino, who over the summer will give demonstrations of the semaphore. Ultimately, it extended as far as Venice, allowing the emperor to get messages to his armies in northern Italy in a matter of a few hours. One such message has been discovered in the records of a nearby village. It reads, "The Legion of the South may recruit men in Turin from among the Piedmontese prisoners of war or Austrian deserters. However, it must not recruit men who are not from Piedmont." This message would have been transcribed into semaphore signs by a superintendent in Paris. It would then have been passed down the chain of stations, each about 10 kilometres or 6 miles apart from the next. In each hut, a single operator had the task of surveying his neighbours by telescope. As soon as there was activity, he copied down the signals and passed them on. Of the meaning of the message, the operator had not a clue. He merely worked the machine. Born into a family of scientists in western France, Claude Chappe, from 1763 to 1805, made the important observation that the human eye is excellent at discerning angles. So he designed a system built around three parts, a long central beam with two shorter arms attached at either end. Each manoeuvre was reckoned to take about 30 seconds, and the messages were transmitted in full, words like de and a included. Telegrammes had not yet been invented. For the operators, it was tiring and laborious, especially as they had pay docked for delays. Still, by all accounts, they acquitted themselves well. The record was 60 minutes for a message travelling from Paris to Strasbourg. It bore the news of the birth of Napoleon's son. We have a description of one of the Chappe stations in Alexandre Dumas' The Count of Monte Cristo, which was written in 1844 and set 30 years earlier. The Count sees the contraption like the claws of an immense beetle and feels wonder that these various signs should be made to cleave the air with such precision as to convey to the distance of 300 leagues the ideas and wishes of a man sitting at a table. He then bribes the operator to send false information down the network, causing a financial panic in Paris. From the outset, the prime purpose of the system was military. 4 years into the revolution, with fears growing of foreign invasion to restore the monarchy, the Republican government commissioned Citizen Chappe to build the first line, from Paris to Lille. A year later, in September 1794, the government heard news, on the very day that it happened, that the northern border town of Condé had been captured. They telegraphed back their congratulations, which were received in Condé the very same evening. New lines opened to Strasbourg, then to Lyon and to Brest. Napoleon built the line to Italy and also, as he contemplated invading England, an extension to Boulogne on the English Channel. Under the restored monarchy after 1815, there were new lines to Marseille and to Bayonne in the southwest. The last stations were built in 1849, but by then it was clear that the days of line-of-sight telegraphy were done. The military needs had disappeared, and latterly the operator's main task was transmitting national lottery numbers. The shortcomings of visual communication were obvious. It only functioned in daytime and in good weather. And of course the invention of electronic telegraphy changed everything. In 1844, Samuel Morse showed that it worked down a wire from Washington to Baltimore in the United States. Soon, the Shap Towers were to look as antiquated as perfumed wigs. Smoke, fire, light, flags. Since time immemorial, man has sought to speak over space. What France did in the first half of the 19th century was to create the first ever system of distance communication. On the long trek to the Internet, it is an overlooked but significant early step. And this news item was sent in by Colin Durrell, VK3, UDC, RAOTC member, number 1244. Thanks very much indeed, Colin, for a very interesting article.
Thanks very much, Clive. Perth Luncheons. The popular and well-attended monthly luncheon for RAOTC members and friends in and around Perth are held on the second Tuesday of each month. The 7 Mile Bar and Bistro is at 501 Wanneroo Road, Balcatta. Their website can easily be found by googling 7 Mile Bar and Bistro. In addition to the main menu, a seniors menu is also available. There is ample parking available in the adjacent car park. The venue is located on Wanneroo Road near the Reed Highway intersection and is readily accessible with car parking available. Since Wanneroo Road is a main thoroughfare for the northern suburbs, public transport via bus is also a viable alternative. The appropriate route and timetable information can be accessed from the TransPerth website. A copy of the URL is located on our website. Alasdair, a VK6ATX, is coordinating the lunch, and it would be appreciated if Alasdair could be notified of those planning to attend to ensure that adequate seating is provided. We look forward to seeing many of you at the ROTC luncheon. Alasdair's email address is vk6kif@bigpond.com. I'll repeat that. Victor Kilo 6, Kilo India Foxtrot, at bigpond.com.
You are listening to VK3OTN and associated relay stations. VK3OTN is the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club Australia Incorporated, with the monthly news and information bulletin for members and friends of the club.
And in keeping tradition, we'll finish this broadcast with a short story. I don't know if this is true or not, but this story certainly may have some merit. During World War II, a French auto manufacturing company, Citroën, were forced to make trucks for the German army. You may recall that Germany was an occupying force in France. Citroën made the dipsticks to show that there was plenty of oil when the truck was actually 2 quarts, that is, a little bit under 2 litres, low. The Germans never did figure out why the engines in Citroën seized up so often. I suppose the French had the last laugh.
That's all we have for you this month, and we hope you found something of interest. Thanks for being with us, and we hope you will join in the callbacks where callbacks are taken. The next IOTC news and information broadcast will take place on the first Monday of February next year, on the same frequencies and at the same times as today, and I hope you've enjoyed our broadcasts throughout the year. If you have missed all a part of this broadcast, or you just want to listen to it again, it is available for download from the IOTC website. Simply go to www.raotc.org.au. Again, the website URL is www.raotc.org.au. On the right-hand side is the main menu. Click on VK3OTN broadcasts and you will be able to see the various times and frequencies of the VK3OTN transmissions by all of our volunteers, provided of course a volunteer is available. Down towards the bottom of the page is the current and previous 5 broadcasts for you to listen to. Sometimes the relay station is an automated broadcast, for example, a repeater, when no operator is available to take callbacks. Other times the volunteer operator suffers from very heavy local queue iron and callbacks are not always possible. Many operators need a small amount of time to switch from playing a recorded file to using a microphone, please be mindful of this. This is VK3OTN signing clear from today's news and information session. 73 and a happy new year from the IOTC broadcast team.